Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present to you Martin A. Lee, the author of the just-released The Beast Reawakens, published in hardcover by Little Brown Books, and obviously, copyright 1997. Martin, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you very much, David.
In the book The Beast Reawakens, you deal with the subject of fascism, part of its history, and also where it's going. You deal with the reemergence of fascism. We've spoken about a number of different aspects of this vitally important book, and I thought for our next discussion, I'd like to begin with an association that you set forth, which illustrates the area of intersection between so-called neo-Nazis and some of the mainstream institutions of a society. We've spoken about the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit in the past, an outfit that grew out of Hitler's Eastern Front intelligence outfit, and you write of the connection between Reinhard Gehlen and a fellow named Gerhard Fry, the head of the DVU. Could you tell us a little about Fry, who he is, and the nature of his association with Gehlen?
Gerhard Fry is a very significant figure within the extreme right in Germany. Fry started out, he's a publisher, a rather wealthy man who publishes several newspapers and magazines, all on the extreme right politically in Germany. And he began his political involvement in the late 1960s at a time when General Reinhard Gehlen was actually retiring from his position as head of the BND, the West German Secret Service. It wasn't known for many years, but Gehlen and Fry had a very close relationship. They were communicating through correspondence and letters. And when, after Gehlen's death, several years after, I should say, Fry actually acknowledged that Gehlen had been one of his supporters in setting up his extreme right-wing Deutsche Volksunion, which started out as a sort of a political club and then evolved into a political party that began running candidates for office during the 1980s, while West and East Germany were still separate countries. And sometime shortly after unification in October 1990, Fry acknowledged in his publication that Gehlen had been one of his supporters and had helped him set up his organization. By that time, Fry's party, the DVU, had already succeeded in electing a handful of candidates in local elections in Länder, in certain German states, that's what Länder means in Germany. In Bremen, for example, and in a couple of other areas, the Deutsche Volksunion, which is the most extreme political party in Germany, actually fielding candidates, managed to secure a few seats in the local government. This sent shockwaves throughout Germany because people just couldn't imagine that a person that was overtly neo-Nazi in its political organization could actually win seats in the local government. And that began actually just shortly before the wall came down, and he picked up momentum, his party, after Germany was reunified. He is one of a handful of political parties on the far right that compete in the elections in Germany.
We've spoken about Fry in the past in connection with the funding of Vladimir Zhirinovsky. Veteran listeners to this broadcast also know the name Gerhard Fry because his the National Zeitung und Soldatenzeitung was the newspaper that first published the information that Lee Harvey Oswald had supposedly fired at General Edwin Walker. This a number of days before that information supposedly was first surfaced to the light of day by Marina Oswald. Perhaps at a later date we could kick around some of the areas of overlap between some of the subject material that you talk about and the assassination of President Kennedy. Not a subject that you deal with directly except in a few places, although H. Keith Thompson, who is a major figure in your book, you reveal was handling much of the PR work for Marguerite Oswald, Oswald's mother.
Yeah, so he claimed. H. Keith Thompson identified himself to me as the key U.S. point man for the post-war Nazi Odessa Network, Odessa being the organization of former SS veterans in Germany. And Thompson was working very closely with this international network from his home base in New York. And this was, of course, starting in the late 40s, early 50s, and he had continual associations over the years with Nazis and fascists around the world. And one of the curious incidents he told me was that after the assassination of Kennedy, he became an advisor and confidant to Oswald's mother, Marguerite. He actually claims he had a sexual affair with Oswald's mother, but I take that with a bit of a grain of salt. But there's no doubt that they did have a business relationship, and he was serving in a PR capacity.
You also mentioned, and as we have discussed in past interviews, H. Keith Thompson during World War II was actually an agent of the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS intelligence service.
Yes, that's what he revealed to me, and he indicated that documentation to this effect of his working for German intelligence during World War II, even though he's an American citizen now, was discovered by Allied forces. As the war was drawing to a close, they came upon a cache of Interpol documents which had this material in its files that showed that H. Keith Thompson was an operative for the German SD, which is the Foreign Intelligence Service of the SS. He's very proud of this to this day. He's still alive, incidentally. He lives in upstate New York near Utica, and he is very proudly to this day an ardent Hitlerite. He has never ceased believing in the National Socialist creed, and he's a very old man now. He may not have much time left to live, but I think this is one of the reasons why he decided to tell me at least part of his story. I'm sure he kept certain things to himself, but one of the things I found quite interesting was that Thompson acknowledged that he was in control of an Odessa bank account in Kitchener, Ontario, in Canada, from which he would selectively disperse funds to Nazi operatives after World War II who were either on the run or on the lam or involved in certain kind of political machinations that the Odessa Network saw fit to support. So he was very instrumental in that. And that ties in directly, David, to the banking scandal we're hearing so much today about in Switzerland. The fact that the Swiss banks had plundered the assets of Holocaust victims is part of a much bigger scandal. And it also entailed the plans by Nazi leaders to place funds in hidden bank accounts as the war was drawing to a close, with an eye toward using these assets after World War II to help rebuild the National Socialist movement. This is exactly what H. Keith Thompson was involved in.
You write about the meeting that took place on August 10, 1944 in Strasbourg in Alsace-Lorraine, in which many of the key German industrialists actually sat down and placed these funds and worked out this flight capital program for the financial and political reemergence of National Socialism.
Yes, and it's not only funds and gold and stolen assets that they were moving in various countries, not just to Switzerland, but to Turkey, Spain, Portugal, all around the world. They were placing them in locations that they would try to access then after the war and use for their own political purposes. But it was not just money. It was actual pieces of machinery, huge pieces of hardware, industrial goods that they were moving, literally entire factories that were involved in making special goods that the Germans sought to move overseas, particularly to Latin America. Argentina is one of the countries that was used in this regard, basically to dissemble entire factories and move them overseas and have these then reconstituted, rebuilt, where they would then be used for part of a plan to rebuild National Socialism.
And also patents and some of the interlocking control of technology that the Germans were able to achieve through some of their remarkable cartel agreements also figures into that scenario.
Yes, I think H. Keith Thompson was involved in some of the patent work, moving the patents around and having these things secured and legally in place so that then the Nazis can access it after the war. He told me he was involved in some of this activity for Otto Skorzeny, who was one of the key players, one of the leaders in the Odessa Network. He was one of the most illustrious, quote-unquote, figures in the SS, having served as Hitler's chief commando during World War II. He was the Third Reich's James Bond. And H.K. Thompson was working closely with Skorzeny after the war. I had seen some of the correspondence between them that H.K. Thompson showed me. So he was definitely in the thick of all this, and it's quite significant that Americans were playing this kind of role early in the Cold War.
Both Otto Skorzeny, whom we've spoken of before, and H. Keith Thompson are individuals whose waters, I guess one could say, lap on many shores. Skorzeny, very active in Latin America, very active in the Middle East, some of those connections evolving into some things which exist to this day in the Middle East. And H. Keith Thompson, an individual who laps on the shores of organizations like the Liberty Lobby and also the Republican Party as a whole. We're going to be talking about the mainstreaming of fascism, which to a certain extent I think one could perhaps call an artificial construct. It's always had entree to elements of the mainstream through powerful industrialists and national security establishments who have either looked with favor or at least with an eye towards using fascism in a practical sense, such as the Galen outfit and its jump to the CIA. With regard to the mainstreaming of fascism, Martin, one of the things that you write about in The Beast Reawakens is how gradually the past is being revised in Germany and also elsewhere, and we're now seeing a reconstruction, historically and politically, of the Hitler period, and you write of the Battle of the Historians, something that took place in the 1980s.
Yes, this was a very interesting event, you might say, that unfolded within academic and media circles in Germany in 1984 and 85, the Historikite debate, the historians debate. And basically, you had certain conservative historians in Germany who began to promote the notion that one should view the Holocaust as one event among many terrible events that happened in the 20th century, not as a singular outstanding event that was unique on its own terms, but as something that could be compared and lumped together with other atrocities in the 20th century. One of the key promoters of this notion was the historian and philosopher Ernst Nolte, who was a student of Martin Heidegger, the famous philosopher in Germany who was at least sympathetic to the Third Reich and at one point at least briefly an open supporter of Hitler during the Third Reich period. And Nolte, while he would eschew the title or the label Nazi or fascist, nonetheless is certainly on the extreme right, and he was instrumental in promoting this idea that the Holocaust was not really unique. And of course, for neo-Nazis and fascists in Germany, this type of argument was very important, because if the Holocaust was not really unique, then why stigmatize Germany? Why keep Germany divided? Remember, this debate unfolded in the 1980s when Germany was still two countries. And if Germany was not unique in terms of the horror that it inflicted during World War II, then why allow such policies as the open immigration policy with respect to political asylum seekers, which was enacted in law in atonement for the Third Reich crimes? Of course, that has been recently overturned, that law, so now it's very difficult for asylum seekers to come to Germany. So this argument was seen as having great utility on the extreme right, and it has slowly worked its way into mainstream thinking, where a lot of people in Germany would espouse that line today. They'd say, yes, the Holocaust, yes, it happened, it was bad, but look, all these other bad things happened too. They essentially relativized the Holocaust. It wasn't outright Holocaust denial, as some in Germany professed, but it was a more subtle type of denial.
I'd like to share a paragraph from page 382 of The Beast Reawakens with the listening audience. Slowly but surely, in ways that were sometimes subtle and sometimes heavy-handed, Germany's past was being transformed, glossed over, touched up, and played down, repackaged, commercialized, trivialized, expunged, and forgotten, as if history were some kind of trick that the living played on the dead. A new national war memorial opened in East Berlin, where an East German monument to the victims of fascism and militarism once stood. The words fascism and militarism were omitted from the replacement memorial, which, quote, utterly fails to distinguish between victims and perpetrators, unquote, according to Berlin's community leader, Jerzy Canal. Not far away, and this next item, Martin, is straight out of The Producers by Mel Brooks. This is absolutely grotesque. I'll read it first and then comment on it. Not far away, state-funded artists had recreated the facade of the Hohenzollern Palace in the center of the city so that Berliners could proudly gaze upon an old imperial glory. And in Poland, the Wolf's Lair, Hitler's Eastern Front command post, was slated for conversion into a private theme park where staffers dressed in replica uniforms of the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe would preside over nightly dancing at, quote, Hitler's Bunker disco, unquote. It's almost like springtime for Hitler, exemplifies what Nietzsche, I think, referred to when he said, a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling. And that's much the way I react when I see something like that. With regard to the erasing of the past in Germany, something that you've spoken about in terms of the mainstreaming of fascism in Germany is the hearkening back to Ernst Nolte exemplifies this, hearkening back to writers from the conservative revolution of the 1920s in the Weimar Republic and a recapitulation to a certain extent of the conservative revolution in contemporary Germany.
I think the conservative revolution is very, very important in terms of understanding what's happening in Germany and Europe in general today. The conservative revolution refers to the period really in the 1920s, a little bit in the 1930s, the period of the Weimar Republic in Germany, but it was also happening, this conservative revolution in other countries, not just Germany. And what it was a cultural movement led by well-known writers and artists, mainly from Germany, but other countries as well, who were attacking and critiquing the democratic basis for the Weimar Republic, were bemoaning the loss of community and folk-rootedness, as they refer to it, in Germany, that you had a society that was being dislocated by advanced industrialization and so forth and so on. And some of the criticisms of these people, such as Ernst Junger, Oswald Spengler, several others along these lines who were associated with the conservative revolution, some of the criticism was actually quite astute and quite appropriate, but they also were supporting authoritarian solutions to what they saw as the problem of the weak democracy of the Weimar Republic, and the conservative revolution in large part, I think, helped set the stage by influencing the cultural mood for the rise of the Nazi Party and Adolf Hitler. It's been said that the conservative revolution was the treasure trove, the ideological treasure trove that the Nazis took many of their ideological weapons from. And I think this is correct. It helps set the stage. But because the conservative revolution, which I feel is a kind of German fascism, but it's not exactly National Socialism, another kind of fascism that occurred simultaneously with the rise of National Socialism, because the conservative revolutionary thinkers, such as Ernst Junger and the others, were not always directly associated with Hitler. Conservatives in Germany today have gone back, looking back to that period before Hitler was in power, to the conservative revolution and its anti-democratic thinkers, and have seen fit to resurrect them, to hold them forth as authentic examples of German conservatism. And certain kind of examples that are very important because they're not overtly tainted with the brush of Nazism. So even though that the conservative revolutionary thinkers embodied many fascist ideas, provides a very convenient way these days for people who sympathize with fascism to sort of resurrect and promote their philosophies without being, you know, tarred by the brush of the swastika. And that's why it's so useful today in Germany within the far right. I think it's a fascinating group of philosophers to look at and to study, and the fact that they're experiencing a revival, they're becoming back in vogue today in Germany, is quite disconcerting when you consider that this is what then laid the basis in the past for the rise of the Third Reich.
Helmut Kohl actually honored Ernst Junger, one of the surviving writers from the conservative revolution of the 1920s.
Yes, Ernst Junger is still alive today. He's over 100 years old. On his 100th birthday, which was in 1995 in March, the leader of Germany, Chancellor Helmut Kohl, paid a visit to Junger. And this was a very symbolic gesture, because while the German government officials will claim that the chancellor was simply honoring an esteemed German writer, an esteemed man of arts and letters in Germany, nonetheless, you can't avoid the fact that here the Chancellor of Germany is sitting down and honoring a person who said he hates democracy like the plague and has never recanted that comment. I mean, this is the kind of things that Junger was saying. He was one of the militant advocates for tearing down the Weimar Republic. He wrote books, glorifying war as a quote-unquote inner experience. He himself served in the Wehrmacht during World War II in France. He was also a veteran of the First World War. And his books were really, you know, glorified war in a way that, you know, it's quite shocking when you would think that, that the Chancellor of Germany would then sit down with this man and honor him like that. I think the symbolism and the implication can't be just simply swept under the rug, and it can't be simply sloughed off as just honoring a great literary figure. Indeed, he is a very powerful writer. But the political implications here, I think, are disturbing. And it's another way that Kohl is able to send a signal to his flank on the extreme right, saying, see, you know, see what I'm doing, guys? Keep supporting me. Don't vote for the parties like the Republican or the DVU, these small fringe parties in the German political landscape. Vote for the Christian Democratic Union. Keep supporting me because I'm with you. That's essentially what he was saying.
With regard to the mainstreaming of fascism, one of the areas in which Helmut Kohl and the CDU began to co-opt, not began, but actually co-opted some of the neo-Nazi agenda in Germany quite successfully, and a theme which was not only exploited by Helmut Kohl and the CDU, but something which is common to many forms of resurgent fascism, not only in Europe, but also in the United States, is an anti-immigrant theme. We spoke in an earlier interview of historian Roger Griffin's estimation of fascism as a supervirus, which constantly mutates to change form to adapt to new environments. The anti-immigrant theme is something which runs across the board from Helmut Kohl and the CDU to Jean-Marie Le Pen and the Front National in France to Jörg Haider's Freedom Party, right on to the Republican Party, Newt Gingrich, and elements that we see in the United States.
Yes, and what you had was a situation in Germany, for example, to start with Germany, where in the mid and late 70s, when neo-Nazi groups began to reemerge outright, you know, flaunting the swastika led by Michael Kunin, which is something we hadn't seen in Germany for a decade or two earlier because it was just considered so beyond the pale, it was considered verboten that even if you were on the extreme right, this is not something you would do, to wear a swastika in public. Well, it was Kunin's people that first started to do that, and they were the ones who really began the rhetorical and physical bashing of immigrants and guest workers, mainly from Turkey, but other countries as well, in Germany. But at that time, they were seen as beyond the pale still. They were still seen as very marginal figures, and their message was basically falling on deaf ears, the anti-immigrant message. But it began to gain some currency, particularly after the wall came down. It was sort of a slow build. But once the wall came down and Germany was reunified, Chancellor Kohl had a problem because he had promised the Germans that Eastern Germany would become a blossoming economic landscape very quickly as a result of unification, and that Western Germans would not have to pay higher costs vis-a-vis taxes or cuts in social services to foot the bill for unification. Well, he was lying. His promises are such that he could not keep them. And rather than owning up to his own policy failures, Kohl and the other mainstream German politicians sought to affix the blame on immigrants. It's not the fault of the government policies that they had really serious economic problems throughout the country after unification. It was because of guest workers, because of asylum seekers. It was because of immigrants, because of people of color, because of non-Germans, because of foreigners as a whole. And this is something that the mainstream politicians found very convenient to do, to co-opt the fascist rhetoric. Basically, they were speaking just like the fascists, to the point where the leader of one of the fascist parties, the Republicaner, led by Franz Schönhuber, said that the Christian Democratic Union has adopted our program. They're saying the same thing as we're saying. This was commented upon by many editorials in German newspapers, that the policies, the program of the Christian Democratic Union, the mainstream conservative party in Germany, was identical to the far right. And what Kohl was ultimately concerned about was not losing votes, was concerned about making sure that his political base would stop hemorrhaging and they would be, less defectors to the far right. And that's why they pursued this course, in order basically to stay in power. Of course, it had very deleterious effects in Germany. I think this kind of imitative response of adopting the far right program in order to defang them or to weaken them, while it seemed to work in the short term in Germany, to the extent that the Republikaner and the Deutsche Volksunion were not able to gain much headway at the polls, I think in the long run it tends to reinforce a very deep strain of virulent nationalism in German society that is bound to reappear in one form or another. In fact, already is reappearing in certain forms. What's interesting is that that dynamic of adopting the rhetoric of the far right to co-opt it, while it had an opposite effect in other countries in Europe. In Austria, led by the Freedom Party led by Jörg Haider, which recently gained 28% of the vote nationally, he had a situation where the mainstream parties tried to co-opt Haider's message, his anti-immigrant message, and it ended up just opening the door further for Haider, ended up strengthening his party rather than weakening it. And that also happened in France and in Italy with the National Front and the National Alliance, respectively. So I think that part of the blame, at the very least, in terms of the resurgence of fascism today in Western Europe, has to be laid at the door of the mainstream political parties, which went through this process of helping these parties inadvertently, the extreme right parties, by trying to weaken them. So I think that's a key factor in terms of what's happening in Western Europe today. And the parallels are obvious in the United States with Patrick Buchanan, David Duke, and the Republican Party, and the anti-immigrant bashing that's going on here as well.
And we're going to be talking about that in the next half-hour segment. I would note in passing that the aforementioned Franz Schoenhuber has a background in the SS, and Jörg Haider's Freedom Party was originally formed in 1949 as a vehicle for the political rehabilitation of Austrian NSDAP members who had allied themselves with Hitler. We have been speaking with Martin Lee, the author of The Beast Reawakens, just out in hardcover issued by Little Brown Books, copyright, of course, 1997, an incredibly important book dealing with the reemergence of fascism. And we're going to be talking about some similarities between some of the things that we've been discussing on the European neo-fascist and reactionary political scene and some things that have been going on here in the United States as well. Martin, I'm looking forward to our next half hour of discussion. For Martin Lee, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.